Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is another episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In fact, to be a little more specific, this will be episode 103. And this episode will be focusing on the internal medicine in-training exam and also, I guess, the medicine board exams. In fact, I'll say this episode is focused very heavily on the EBIM exam and the medicine ITE exam, and it's also partially focused on step three, because many of the things that are invariably tested on those exams, right, they kind of show up on step three as well. So this is something that will be good for medicine residents to listen to, and if you're also taking step three and you just want to beef up your internal medicine knowledge for step three, that'll be a good way to go. So today I'm going to be talking about cardiology, and as I've done in the other parts of the series, I'm just going to use a key scenarios and then basically describe the various ways the concept could be tested on an exam. Okay, and today really I'm just going to focus on cardiology, because cardiology is a very high yield part of these tests, right? I mean, like, if you look at the medicine board exam, cardiology makes up about almost 15% of the questions that are tested, right? So it's kind of like one of those things you want to know. Okay, so let's assume you get a question about a patient that is, like, you know, 60-year-old guy, has like a past history of like hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, and is coming in with, like, you know, like severe mid-sternal chest pain radiating to the jaw, and you check the troponins, they're negative, but he has like non-specific T-wave changes on an EKG, right? What would your next step in diagnosis or management be? Right? I mean, obviously you want to give like the drugs and whatnot, but let's assume that they're basically asking about like a next diagnostic step. Would you want to send this patient for a stress test? I would hope not, right? I would hope not under those circumstances. This patient is very high risk, right? So because this patient is very high risk for coronary artery disease, right? More specifically an MI, even with the negative troponins and whatnot, it doesn't matter. This patient actually needs a cardiac catheterization, right? Because if you were to say, oh, you know what, Divine, come on, why can't I do a, this person has negative trops, why can't I do like a regular stress test? The thing is, let me ask you this question. Just think about it yourself. If you have this kind of patient, they come in, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, past medical history, chest pain radiating to the jaw, everything, and then you get a stress test. If that stress test is negative, would you feel comfortable sending those patients home? I would hope that your answer to that question is a no, right? So because you don't feel comfortable sending those patients home, right, that tells you right off the bat, right, that that patient is very high risk. If a patient is very high risk for coronary artery disease, you don't think about getting a stress test and all that crap. No, you just proceed straight to coronary angiography. Okay, that's the next step, because again, for patients with such high risk, if you get the results of a test, of a stress test, and it's negative in those basically this kind of patient, you do not trust the results of that stress test. The result of that stress test, I'll probably say it's one where that's likely a false negative, right? Because remember, if a person has like very high risk for a particular disease, right, if you get a negative test result from a particular test, that negative test result is likely negative, right? It has a high probability of being a false negative, right? That's basically like Bayes' theorem. The thing is, it's not like they're going to ask you like super specific, like, make intense biostats, whatever calculations on your medicine boards. But the kinds of questions they will go after, like, it's basically the kind, it's not necessarily like being able to do the math. It's more being able to understand the mechanism or the pathophys, if you may, behind like the application of biostats to clinical concepts, right? So this kind of patient, right, where, oh, if the person got a stress test and it was negative, you still won't feel comfortable sending the patient home. That would be like a Bayes theorem example of where, like, because this person is such high risk for coronary artery disease, a negative stress test, right, will likely be a false negative, right? So if a patient has like very high risk for disease, and you're sending them for a stress test, that's probably not a good idea, because the false negative rate of that test, especially if it comes out as negative, is likely high. Okay, so that's just basically a Bayes' theorem in a nutshell. But compare my initial vignette, right, with a person that, you know, basically presents and they have like, let's say it's like a 50-year-old guy. He says he just has this chest pain that kind of started this morning. And let's say he has like a history of hypertension. So he has like that risk factor going for him. But he doesn't necessarily have like hyperlipidemia or diabetes. And he says that resting or like exercising doesn't make the pain worse. Resting doesn't necessarily make the pain better. Right, and the pain maybe was like a fleeting chest pain, right? You're like, okay, this person is 50 years old. This person has some chest pain. Let's assume it's like mid-sternal, you know, sort of radiating, I don't know, to the axilla or something, right? So this kind of patient, right, this is not the, and let's assume you get an EKG and it's like unremarkable. You get tropes and they're unremarkable. This patient, yeah, this is not the kind of patient you want to send to the cath lab, right? Because this patient is low risk from the beginning, this patient is not high risk, right? But this patient is probably someone you'll consider to be like intermediate risk. For a patient like this, a stress test will be an awesome, awesome, awesome thing to do, right? Because again, the patient is intermediate risk. When people are very high risk, like the first vignette I described, you send them to a cardiac cath. But if the patient is intermediate risk, you then send them for a stress test, okay? The thing is, this is where Bayes' theorem shines really well, right? Because if you're a person at intermediate risk, then by getting a stress test, that can help you either upstage the person's risk. I mean, obviously, say for example, the stress test is positive, right? Then you proceed with a cardiac cath. But let's assume the stress test was like negative, right? That can help you sort of downstage your risk. So basically, Bayes' theorem essentially tells you that if a person is very high risk for a particular condition, go for the diagnostic test, okay? If a patient is like intermediate risk, right, like the second vignette I described, you do not necessarily need to go for like a cardiac cath. You go for something like a stress test, and I'll talk about those stress tests shortly. But if the patient is like low risk, right, from the beginning, chances are, so let's sort of play this game from a second angle, right? So remember I said that very high risk person, if you send them for a stress test and you get a negative result from that stress test, you're not going to believe those negative results, right? Because chances are in the presence of that negative result, you're like, this is a false negative, right? Now let's assume you have like a 20-year-old guy, he's an athlete, you know, he's pretty healthy. His BMI is like 22, he eats healthy food, doesn't have any past medical history, and he comes in and says, oh, doc, I have like this fleeting chest pain, his EKG is clean, his tropes are clean, right? The thing is, those kinds of patients that are low risk, you probably do not want to send them for a stress test. Because think about it from the other angle. If you got a stress test for those people, right, and that stress test ended up being positive in this like 20-something-year-old guy that's like super healthy, chances are that positive test is not something you believe, right? That in the presence of a positive test result, if you're a low-risk person, that positive test result is likely a false positive, okay? So again, you may say, Divine, why are you spending so much time crapping about a Bayes' theorem? I promise you, for your medicine board exams and the in-training exam, they test things around that Bayes' theorem concept. Because it's actually one of those things where if you actually understand the concept, which I'm trying to use different analogies and scenarios to explain, it can actually help you quite a bit with like more like prudent clinical decision making. So I've been making this fuss about stress tests, right? So what are the different kinds of stress tests and which ones do you choose, right? I mean, there's like exercise stress tests, there is pharmacological stress tests, there's stress echo, there's stress EKG and all that crap. Which one do you pick on exams, right? So the thing is, for this, you kind of have to like make one major decision at the beginning. And the major decision is, can the patient exercise, okay? If the patient can exercise, you need to send them for an exercise-based stress test. If the patient cannot exercise for any reason, then you send them to a non-exercise-based stress test. So what do I mean, for example, right? So if, for example, a patient has like very severe like peripheral vascular disease, or the patient has like an amputated extremity, or the patient has just basically any like real reason, usually it's peripheral vascular disease on exams, or it may be like some orthopedic problem, Under those circumstances, you send them for a pharmacological stress test, okay? So whenever you're thinking, when you get an exam question and the answer choices are all stress tests and you're trying to decide what to do, the first big decision you want to make is ask yourself, can this person exercise? If they can exercise, send them for an exercise-based stress test. And then the next decision you want to make, because the thing is, these exams, right, in the head of an exam, you're panicking and all that crap. You want to have an approach to answering certain questions. So after you ask yourself, can they exercise or not? The next question you want to ask yourself is, do they have any underlying EKG anomaly, right? So take, for example, if they have like a left bundle branch block, or they have like STT wave changes already and whatnot, right? That would kind of make like an EKG based stress test very hard to read. So under those circumstances, for those people, you should not pick a stress test that involves an EKG. If a person has like an underlying like rhythm, like a bad arrhythmia, or like a left bundle branch block, or like left ventricular hypertrophy, stuff like that, you absolutely do not want to pick an EKG based stress test under those circumstances. You want to go for a stress test that involves an echo. Okay, so that's like the next big decision you want to make. So first decision, can they exercise or not? If they can exercise, send them for an exercise-based stress test. And then the second decision is, do they have an underlying EKG anomaly? If they have an underlying EKG anomaly, you should not choose an EKG-based stress test. Okay, and then for the people that cannot exercise, right, obviously you still need to stress them out in some way, shape or form. The thing is, you stress them out with pharmacology, right? And the thing is, in terms of stressing people out with pharmacology, you can use one of two options, right? So you can use a positive inotrope like dobutamine. Remember, dobutamine is a beta 1 agonist, and remember, you find those beta 1 receptors in very high quantity on the surfaces of your cardiac myocytes, right? So they increase like your heart rate and your cardiac output and all that crap, right? So you can use dobutamine under those circumstances. Another alternative is you can use an adenosine analog, right? So you can use adenosine. Some weird names you may see on your exam, they kind of sound like adenosine, right? So there's like this drug known as regadenosine. There's this other drug known as apadenosine. They all sound like adenosine, right? They are all adenosine analogs, and you can use them for stress tests. Another thing you can use is you can use dipyridamole, right? So dipyridamole is an antiplatelet drug, okay? It's actually a very good vasodilator. It works as a vasodilator by multiple mechanisms. For example, right, it inhibits like phosphodiesterase. So that's something that's more like step 1, step 2, step 3 fodder. If you're interested in that, just let me know. You can send me an email, I can try to explain. But basically, by inhibiting phosphodiesterase, it can make cyclic AMP persist. If that persists, that will make smooth muscle relax, and you have vasodilation. But another thing is dipyridamole also inhibits adenosine deaminase, and adenosine deaminase is an enzyme that breaks down adenosine. So if you inhibit adenosine deaminase, adenosine will persist for longer, and we know that adenosine is a vasodilator, okay? So you can basically use that as your vasodilator for your stress test. So the thing is, what if they write an exam question that involves you? You're like, oh, okay, this person cannot exercise, and you need to pick pharmacologic source of stress, right? And they give you both as answer choices. Like they put dobutamine as an answer choice, they put dipyridamole as an answer choice, right? The thing is, under those circumstances, right, because again, remember, whenever you're taking an exam, there can only be one right answer, right? Because if there were two right answers to an exam question, everyone will go to the ABIM headquarters or whatever and protest and all that stuff, right? Obviously, they wouldn't want to do that on a test, right? So the thing is, this is just being a good test taker. Whenever you take an exam, there's only one correct answer. It just makes sense. So if they give you two things, you're like, man, come on, these two things are right. Like dobutamine is okay, dipyridamole is okay. Then the next thing, basically, like, again, all this thing is just test taking strategy. The next thing you need to begin to think about is what kinds of contraindications exist, right? So say, for example, right, if the patient has a history of like asthma, you probably do not want to pick like an adenosine-based pharmacological stress option, right? Because remember, adenosine causes very significant bronchospasm, right? So if a person has a history of like a bronchospastic disease, right? So they have like asthma, or they have like real bad COPD, right? Under those circumstances, it is probably not a great idea to go for to go for an adenosine-based stress test. And remember, right, adenosine, remember, it's one of those things you can give if a person has like a really bad like tachyarrhythmia, and you want to sort of slow down the heart, especially like an SVT. You want to slow down the heart and sort of see the rhythm. You can give adenosine. If you know that adenosine can basically slow conduction down the AV node, well, if a person has like AV nodal conducting disease, like I don't know, like a second degree AV block or a third degree AV block, it is not a great idea on the medicine board exam to give those people. To give those people an adenosine, right? Because again, that can maybe turn like a second degree V block to like a third degree V block, right? And then you have a problem on your hands, right? So under those circumstances, probably not a great idea to give an adenosine a B stress test, right? But what if you're like, oh, okay, Divine, what are the contraindications to dobutamine, right? I mean, dobutamine, I just told you, it's a beta-1 agonist. It increases your heart rate, increases your cardiac output. If a person has like a bad tachyarrhythmia, like VTach, for example, right? Or they have like a left bundle branch block, or they have like a pacemaker. Basically, I'll just tell you this. If a patient has like a notable arrhythmia, or they have like bad hypertension, those people should not get a dobutamine stress option, okay? If you're choosing a pharmacologic stress test. So very high yield to know those things, right? So again, big decisions you want to take in choosing a stress test. Can they exercise? If they cannot exercise, you go with a pharmacologic option. And then the second question you want to ask yourself is, do they have any underlying EKG changes? That's basically the way you approach those problems on these board exams, right? Because again, if a person can exercise, you want to exercise them, because really the exercise stress test, yeah, you can see blah blah blah, but it also gives you like other useful information, right? Like the exercise capacity. It can give you like information that can tell you that, you know what, this person's cardiac disease is real bad versus this person's cardiac disease is not that bad, right? So stuff like that, like prognostic information, you can actually get that from an exercise-based stress test. So just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay. And then, right, so what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient has, well, maybe they show you like a picture right on your test, and they tell you that this patient, maybe it's an immigrant, and maybe they've had TB for a long time, and then they show you like a chest X-ray or chest CT, and you see like white stuff all around the heart. What's your diagnosis under those circumstances? I hope you're thinking about like a constrictive pericarditis, right? Okay, good. And I will encourage you to look up pictures of these things and sort of know how to identify them. But constrictive pericarditis, classically on these board exams, they'll put like a lot of white stuff. Because remember, right, if something is white, that means it's radio opaque. So that means it attenuates X-rays very well, right? So something that has like bone density, right, like calcium, right? So like constrictive pericarditis. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about an athlete that passes out on the field and dies afterwards? Or they tell you that, oh, there's this athlete that's presenting with chest pain, and the person's dad died of, I don't know, let's say they died of like a car, died in a car accident at the age of like 30, right? Kind of like a weird story, right? I really hope with these things you're thinking about like a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? Remember, under those circumstances, those people have like a very thick like interventricular septum, right? So those are things they could potentially show you as an image on the exam. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they say, oh, this patient recently, let's assume this patient came in, they show you an EKG, and the patient's heart rate is like in the 30s, right? So they're like bradycardic. So you start pacing them and whatnot. Or they can even present this as a patient that gets like an AICD or like a pacemaker, right? So like for some other cardiovascular problem. And then they tell you that, oh, like a day or two after the procedure, this patient is like persistently hypotensive, has like signs of like a right ventricular dysfunction potentially on an exam, right? So let's say they tell you that, oh, the person has like really bad JVD, right? And let's assume they show you an EKG, like a new EKG, and you're seeing like a low voltage EKG, or they have like variations in the amplitude of the QRS complexes. So let's say they have like a very tall QRS complex followed by a very short QRS complex, right? Like electrical alternance sort of deal, right? I really hope under those circumstances you're thinking of like cardiac tamponade, right? Those people have like a bad pericardial effusion that you've basically caused by inadvertently puncturing their ventricles. And for those people, right, obviously you want to called cardiac surgery. They probably do like a pericardial window or like some kind of pericardiocentesis. Those are the answer choices you want to pick out on an exam. Okay, now what if you get a question? With me talking about like these pacemakers, I would look up pictures of like a pacemaker and like its leads, right? That's like another high yield picture that may show up on these medicine board exams, right? Because those pacemaker lead wires, right? Like usually you put one like in the ventricle, right? So you can put one like in the right atrium, you can put one in the right ventricle. And usually like the one you put in the ventricle, you put it like close to the septum, right? So just be able to identify, oh, which is which. On an MBME exam, I think that's, I keep saying MBME because I do a lot of podcasts for the MBMEs. But for the ABIM exam, okay, just look up pictures, like be able to identify, oh, this lead is in the right atrium, this lead is in the right ventricle. Usually on imaging, the right atrial, like pacemaker lead, it's usually like right, just about to the right of the spine on the chest x-ray. If it's not to the right, it may be like just a little, like it's almost like off center to the right of the spine. Okay, it's very close to the spine on the right. So that's usually the right atrial lead, because remember the right atrium constitutes the right heart border on a chest x-ray, right? But another thing that if you ask like, oh, define, how do I identify the right ventricular lead? The right ventricular lead is usually to the left of it's usually to like the left of the spine on like a chest x-ray. If they wanted to trick you and like make your life like a little miserable, they can show you like a lateral chest x-ray, like a lateral film, and then they ask you to, oh, like which one is the right atrial lead, which one is the right ventricular lead. The right ventricular lead will be anterior to the right atrial lead, because again, remember, the most anterior cardiac chamber is the right ventricle. Okay, so those are things you want to keep at the back of your mind with these tests. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient and the patient presents with, let's say it's like a 70-year-old guy and he's beginning to have like exercise intolerance and he's been having like chest pain that's worse with exercise, and then they tell you that he has like a weak, thready, carotid pulse, right? What kind of murmur are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about aortic stenosis, right? Remember, that is your classic... it'll be a systolic murmur, right? It'll be a systolic murmur that relates to the carotids. You already know your pulsus pravus et tardus from your USMLE exams. And basically, whenever a person is symptomatic, right, from AS, you need to go ahead and you need to consider surgery in those people pronto, right? You want to go ahead and perform an aortic valve replacement. Basically, if a person is symptomatic from most cardiac diseases, you need to like do something, right, on these ABIM exams. And remember, aortic stenosis, right, the pathophys involves calcification of the valve. Okay, believe it or not, for these valvular problems, they love to occasionally test like pathophys, right? So if a person has like aortic stenosis, is like calcification of the valve. If a person has if a patient has like mitral valve or prolapse, right, you're thinking about like Myxomatous degeneration of the valve, right? That's like the classic thing they love to test, right? So those things you want to keep them in mind for these exams, right? So aortic stenosis, obviously you go ahead and replace the valve. You're not going to be doing medical management. Once the person is becoming symptomatic from aortic stenosis, their 3-year life expectancy is very low. So under those circumstances, you want to go ahead and perform an aortic valve replacement. Okay, and again, remember, you may see calcification of an aortic valve. Just, I would encourage you to just be able to identify this on imaging, if you could, for an exam. And then, what if they give you a question about, like, I don't know, like an immigrant that has, they tell you that, oh, he comes to the doctor's office, he's been having, like, some chest pain recently, and then when you auscultate this person's chest, you hear like a diastolic murmur, like an opening snap at the apex, right? I hope you know that this is pretty classically like mitral stenosis, right? It's a diastolic murmur because the left ventricle is filling, right, when the mitral valve is supposed to be open, right? So it's a diastolic murmur, opening snap. And if it's an immigrant, right, what caused this immigrant's mitral stenosis? I really hope you're seeing rheumatic fever, right? I really, really hope you're seeing a rheumatic fever. That's the thing you want to keep in mind, especially with an immigrant, right? And remember that mitral stenosis is the biggest risk factor for what cardiac condition? It's actually the biggest risk factor for AFib, okay? It's the biggest risk factor for AFib. So again, it's risk factors. I promise you, they are floridly high yield for these internal medicine board exams and in-training exams. I will encourage you to listen to the risk factors podcast. I believe it's episode 37. And then there is one of the episodes I made recently. It's like in the 90s on the website. It's called like the most important podcast, where it basically talks about like the most common cause of death in this, the biggest risk factor for that, blah, blah, blah. I'll encourage you. Those are like easy freebie points on exams. But those are things that you either know or you don't know, right? I mean, how many people will think of mitral stenosis as the biggest risk factor for AFib? So I'll encourage you to sort of look those up in those podcasts. Okay, so mitral stenosis, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient that has, they tell you that this patient has like bounding pulses, and then they tell you that this patient has like a holosystolic murmur that is heard best at the left sternal border. What kind of murmur are you thinking about under those circumstances? That'll be aortic regurg, right? That'll be aortic regurg. And remember, classically on exams, people with aortic regurg, they have like just weird blood pressures, right? Like, oh, their blood pressure is like 110 over 40, right? Or like 110 over 50, right? What's unique about that? I hope you're thinking about the pulse pressure, right? The pulse pressure is really wide. Basically, I don't want to make this podcast super long, but widened pulse pressures, if you sort of reason through the pathophys of aortic regurg or like a patent ductus arteriosus, those kind of have similar pathophys. Those are like the two cardiac like valvular problems that are associated with like the wider pulse pressures. So I'll be able to, if you see like wide pulse pressures, holosystolic murmur, left sternal border, that's aortic regurgitation. Pick that answer and don't look back, okay? And then the other like key high yield murmurs, right? So remember, if a person has so I've talked about mitral stenosis, talked about mitral regurg, talked about aortic stenosis, talked about aortic regurg. Remember, if a person has like a holosystolic murmur, right? Or a patient has like some kind of murmur that is asymptomatic, or a patient has like a diastolic murmur of any kind, or a patient has a systolic murmur that is 3+, right? So like a 3/6 systolic murmur, 3, 4, 5, or 6/6 or whatever, right? Those patients need some kind of echo, right? So your next step in diagnosis for those patients is to go ahead and get an echo. And usually on the board exams, a TTE is just fine. There are certain situations where a TEE is a great idea on these board exams. But I'll tell you that there are usually few and far between. So like you could get a TEE if, for example, a patient has like endocarditis, right? A TEE is actually indicated in the setting of endocarditis, or if you're trying to like, I don't know, like cardiovert someone for like AFib, aflutter, right? Under those circumstances, you want to go ahead and get a TEE. That's a great idea. I'm under those circumstances. And something just popped into my mind. I forgot to mention it few minutes ago, but remember that person I talked about, like the cardiac tamponade or like the pericardial effusion from like placing like a lead from like a pacemaker or whatever, you like puncture the person's like ventricle and cause like a pericardial effusion, right? Be able to identify a pericardial effusion on a chest x-ray, okay? It'll sort of show up as like a heart that kind of like looks like a water bottle. It doesn't really, I'll say like water bottle shaped heart in a pediatric question is probably tetralogy of Fallot, but in an adult, and it, let's assume it's something that develops like acutely, you really want to think more about like a pericardial effusion slash a tamponade. Okay, now, what if you get a question about a patient that has like high blood pressures in the upper extremities and low blood pressures in the lower extremities? And then how about we leave it at that, right? So what are you thinking about under those circumstances? But I hope you're thinking about like a quartation of the aorta, right? I remember in adults, a quartation of the aorta usually sort of arises distal to like the left subclavian, right? Because remember, if you look at the aorta, right, so you have like your ascending aorta, your arch, and your descending aorta. For your arch, right, you have the first thing that comes off is your brachiocephalic artery, right, that gives off the right common carotid and the right subclavian. And then after that, the next vessel that comes off is the left common carotid, and then the next vessel that comes off is the left subclavian. Usually the aortic quartation arises distal to the left subclavian. Those people have like very big like brachial arteries and all that stuff, and they will have like all these extensive like collateral like intercostal arteries, right? And the thing is, I sort of think of it this way, right? It's like if a person is getting like ripped and ripped and ripped, some people say, oh, those people are shredded, right? So I sort of think of it this way, like if you have like those collaterals developing, especially like your intercostal arteries, right, shredded intercostal arteries will begin to shred the ribs, right? So those people could have like the rib notching. Another thing you may see with aortic quartation is something called the three sign. The three sign is just like the aorta that's dilated before the quartation and the aorta that is dilated after the quartation. Okay, so you want to be able to actually identify those things on a chest x-ray for the ABIM exam. The ABIM exam, believe it or not, they've been known to test pictures. So I will strongly, strongly, strongly encourage you to be able to identify those things on imaging. Okay. Let's see. What else do I want to talk about? Because I don't want this podcast to go on for too long. Let's see. What else do I want to talk about? Okay. You know what? How about we go ahead and talk about... Okay, let me give you a case scenario. So what if you get a question about a person that's like, I don't know, like 6 foot, 6 inches, and then they present with like tearing chest pain, radiating to the back. You already know what I'm talking about, right? That's aortic dissection, right? And aortic dissection, right? Classically, you'll say, oh, why didn't mediastinum on a chest x-ray, right? So let's assume you wanted to confirm on imaging, right? For those people, you can do like a CT of the chest, right? You can do an MRA, you can do a TEE, right? This is actually one of those fancy schmancy indications for a TEE as well on the ABIM exam, right? So a TEE or CT of the chest or an MRA, those are good situations. Those are good things you can do for aortic dissection, right? And remember, they may give you like a tall person, right? So obviously like Marfan syndrome or like ADPKD, autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. Those people tend to get aortic dissections. And the pathophys actually beyond, like the buzzword pathophysiology you may see on exams relating to aortic dissection is something called a cystic medial necrosis, okay? That's a buzz phrase you want to remember for tests. Believe it or not, they love to test those annoying things. And then, remember for aortic dissection, right, you want to be able to classify them, Stanford A, Stanford B. Basically, if aortic dissection involves the ascending aorta, right, that's a Stanford A. If it does not involve the ascending aorta, that's a Stanford B. Stanford B, medical management. Okay, Stanford A, medical management, but you also need to proceed to surgery, right? And by medical management on these exams, basically what I mean is to give them a beta blocker, okay? You need to give them some kind of beta blocker. That's basically what you do for aortic dissection. But if it's a Stanford type A and it involves the ascending aorta, right, so you give the beta blocker and then you send them to surgery. Okay, now, another thing to keep at the back of your mind with aortic dissection is, right, it's not only people with Marfans or ADPKD that can get that, right? So people with like bicuspid aortic valve, right, you can actually get aortic dissection on these ABIM exams, right? And bicuspid aortic valve, remember, think of it if a person gets like aortic stenosis and they're like in their 50s, right? Remember, bicuspid aortic valve certainly increases your risk of early onset aortic stenosis. And then don't forget, like, if they give you a person with like risky behaviors that has the tearing chest pain, remember syphilis, right? Remember, syphilis loves to cause problems at the level of like the ascending aorta. So that can be another classic presentation on an exam. And then I guess to go ahead and To go ahead and round up, let me just go ahead and talk about a topic that may show up on a test, right? So it's something called like an intra-aortic balloon pump, right? So an intra-aortic balloon pump is something that you basically use when a person has like really depressed cardiac function. You essentially use it when you're trying to like make a bridge to, I don't know, like a left ventricular assist device, for example, or like a heart transplant, right? It's something you kind of use to help the person like temporarily, right? And basically the balloon pump, you usually place it like at the like supraproximal descending thoracic aorta, right? So like distal to the like your left subclavian artery, right? I mean you would not want to place it proximal to any of your great vessels, right? That, I mean, you can already see how that could potentially be a bad idea, right? Because if you do that, you basically occlude one of the vessels that feeds the brain, and then you give your patient a stroke, right? Which is usually not a good outcome, right? But the way the intra-aortic balloon pump works is that it inflates in diastole, and the reason it inflates in diastole is, remember, your coronary vessels sort of come off like the aortic like sinuses, right? So if it inflates in diastole, that will sort of like increase like perfusion of the coronary vessels, right? But it deflates in systole, and the thing is, by deflating in systole, it would basically decrease the it will decrease the afterload on the left ventricle, right? And that will make it easier for the left ventricle to sort of eject blood. So that's kind of like how the intra-aortic balloon pump works. So cardiology, again, this will not be my last internal medicine or cardiology podcast. Cardiology is a super, super floridly high yield topic for the medicine boards, right? Again, like I said, it basically constitutes about 15% of the exam. Okay, so I think that's where I'll go ahead and round up. And as I always do at the end of every exam, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, and Step 3. And then preclinical exams in med school, third-year shelf exams, the medicine in training exam, the medicine board exams. I do offer tutoring for those. And then if you know a person that is taking like basically like most college pre-med courses, biochem, physiology, histology, physics, gen chem, whatever, I offer tutoring for those things. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer consulting for those, like application advising, personal statement help, and whatnot. Pretty much everyone I worked with this last cycle matched. And I've also been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for a year. So I've sifted through thousands of very high quality applications. So I know things that can basically beef up your application. So if you need help in any of those, or you know anyone that needs help in any of those things, please feel free to tell them to reach out to me. So have a wonderful day. It's past 10 p.m. So it looks like I'll be going to bed very soon. So I'll see you next time. Have a great day and have a good night, and God bless you. See you.